they broke the law, how casually, you know, the motivation of it was so based now, in, you know, just financial calculations, you know, trying
now, Kurt,
to
you have a
pull
lot of people
a lousy business
a
out
lot
of the fire.
There are a lot of people who are opposed to the embargo, who felt it was wrong, except you, Donald Trump would not be in that category publicly because, as you point out in the Miami Herald, he said, I would rather take a financial hit than become a financial backer of one of the world's most brutal dictators. How do you know in this last minute that Donald Trump directly knew about this $68,000 expenditure?
Well, two things. First of all, the $68,000 was coming out from the very highest reaches of the company. It wasn't like there was some accountant doing it. The president and chief executive officer were in charge. The chief financial officer was involved. And I know from people who were directly involved in the circumstances, who were there, that Trump knew and was fully on board. You know, you don't write a $68,000 check and not, and it was actually a $100,000 check because they were paying for other things too, on it with a consultant that Trump is dealing with personally and have nobody know about it. But yes, he knew.
And the investigation that you did of the cover up afterwards of executive.
What that entailed was after the money had been paid, there are ways for a humanitarian effort to be expended in Cuba that are legal. And it was, well, maybe we should try and make it look like this. Maybe we should get a charity to have sponsored our trip. It doesn't work that way. And you can't do a business deal or a business transaction or a business trip, and then say, oh, let's make it look like it's a humanitarian trip.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Kurt Eichenwald, thanks for joining us. We'll link to your piece at Newsweek, Vanity Fair. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland. The time is now 5:01 p.m., and coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of AFFECT, a community event about the work, culture, and design of social change. The conference will take place October 7th and 8th at the Ziba Auditorium in Portland. AFFECT will feature talks from Spawn on Me creator and podcaster Khalif Adams, Ferguson activist and social impact designer Dee Nichols, Nadia Gathers from Code 2040, and many more. Again, that's AFFECT, October 7th and 8th at the Ziba Auditorium, 810 Northwest Marshall Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune into KBOO Friday, September 30th from 8 to 9 p.m. for the Night of 1,000 PSAs.
Performed by the Kathleen Stevenson Retirement PSA Orchestra.
There's no need for that lard
Please
to go to waste.
girlsanddrinking.org for
Parents,
weight.
The good news is
I start to cough.
Even within the most trustworthy professions.
I don't want to be a piece of garbage.
There's someone.
This is the action.
Sounds like another concerned citizen.
We will enchant you with everyone's favorite radio treasure.
The PSA.
Played in a way you've never heard before.
All at once.
Again.
That's Friday, September 30th.
8 to 9 p.m.
Here on your favorite
community radio station,
KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's Chinatown dance band The Slants heads to the Supreme Court over their years-long effort to copyright their name.
Even after Trump meltdown on social media today, Clinton's lead in the presidential race is slim.
And the Earth's climate has passed a grim milestone.
Good Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 30th, 2016. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. The Chinatown rock band known as The Slants will bring their copyright case to the U.S. Supreme Court. The band has been trying to copyright their name since 2011, but the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has consistently refused, arguing that the word is racist even if an Asian person seeks to use it. At issue is whether or not the disparaging provision of what is called the Lanham Act is unconstitutional. In the U.S. Court of Appeals last year, the federal government lost to the ban when the court ruled the government's interpretation of the Lanham Act is unconstitutional and that Simon Tam, leader of the Slants, should be allowed to copyright the band's name. Tam's attorney argues that even white supremacist groups have been allowed by the U.S. Patent Office to copyright words and products. This case also impacts the legal appeal by the Washington Redskins against the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, in which the federal government canceled the team's right to use the Native American name and imagery because it was racist. If the Slants win at the Supreme Court, the Washington Redskins might win too.
A white privilege survey that was circulated to Aloha High School seniors earlier this week has apparently created a mild controversy in the Washington County town. The survey, which was created by Peggy McIntosh of the Wellesley College Center for Research on Women, is intended to create empathy and teach students how to have a larger and more challenging conversation about these issues. Many parents have voiced support and said it's important to talk about race, but a few have suggested that the way the survey questions are written may almost shame the respondent for being white. The survey was originated in 1988 and came from the author's recognition that racism is something that puts others at disadvantage, but that whites frequently had not been taught to recognize that their own whiteness was often an inherent advantage. Although the survey has been used as a teaching tool for nearly 30 years, it is apparently still capable of generating controversy.
Dr. Larry Sherman speaks Monday at Science on Tap about the neuroscience of intrinsic bias. The event is called You and Your Racist Brain, the Neuroscience of Prejudice. His talk is Monday, October 3rd at Revolution Hall. There's a ticket fee. You can find out more online at viaproductions.org. That's viaproductions.org. KBOO's Lisa Levin caught up with him this morning to ask about his work.
Right. So, again, just to kind of clarify that. So when we speak about prejudice, and this is something everybody's brain does. We see somebody who looks different from us, and our brain reacts differently than when we see somebody who looks the same as us. And when we talk about racism, again, that's more of a learned behavior that happens over time through exposure to stereotypes on television, for example, in advertising, or in comments we hear from people in our families or around us. And it's part of this again, a system whereby we start behaving differently towards people as a result of the prejudices that we experience. And when we look, the studies that have been done on this topic that I'll be reviewing in this talk are studies where, for example, they'll have put a white person in a scanner, a brain scanner. We call it a functional magnetic resonance imaging, which has some strengths and some weaknesses, but the data that are really reproducible suggests that in cases where you have somebody who looks at a face that looks more like themselves, a white person looking at a white person, for example, areas that in the brain that are involved in facial recognition light up right away. If you put somebody who's an unfamiliar face, a person of color, then actually that's not the first thing that happens. Other areas of the brain light up, including areas that can be associated with sort of threat-like responses. What's remarkable is that if the person has some familiarity with that face, even though they're not in their own group, then in that case, you start to get the facial recognition again. So it's remarkable that just a little bit of familiarity is enough to overcome this effect. But the effect is definitely there, and that's really the prejudicial part of it. The next question, though, is what do you do with that information? So if your brain is reacting to something as a threat, and it's not really a threat, it's just a threat because of this automatic prejudice response, can you overcome that and say, okay, this is not really an issue? And this is where the question of racist types of behaviors come in. There are people who do, and there are people who don't react that way. And again, that really boils down to a number of learned behaviors.
Wow. Okay. 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 One last question. Dr. Larry Sherman, professor of neuroscience, going to be speaking at this really interesting event about the neuroscience of prejudice, as we've been saying. Who do you want to come to that event, and what do you want them to take away from it, if I could ask?
I would love everybody to come to this event, and I'd like everybody to think about it, because it affects, you know, everybody in our community in different ways. And I think the key is to understand that, you know, racism is just bad for everybody. It's bad for the victims of racism who feel that they're not, you know, getting the same opportunities and the same privileges that others are getting. It's bad for the racists because they're stressed out in a society where they think there's this constant threat. And in fact, I mentioned earlier these hormonal changes, the stress hormones. You know, our bodies were not meant to have high levels of stress hormones all the time. And so I think you can make a real case that racism is a public health problem. And, you know, having these high levels of stress hormones because of racism, either because you're, again, someone who is the victim of racism or someone who's engaged in racism or has racist thoughts, both of those people are going to be stressed out. And that has to change. I mean, it's a huge cost on our society in so many ways, including our health. So I'd love everybody to come and hear that.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Authorities have released cell phone and surveillance camera videos of the shooting of an apparently unarmed black man by a police in El Cajon, California. The video shows two officers confronting Alfred Olongo, 38, on Tuesday afternoon before one of them opens fire on him. The cell phone video shows Olongo weaving in a parking lot as an officer approaches him with his gun drawn. Olongo then clapped his hands together and pointed them at the officer, Richard Gonzalez, who opened fire. The killing of Olongo brought several days of protest in the San Diego suburb. Olongo immigrated from Uganda with his family in 1991. Family members say Olongo had been suffering from a mental breakdown Tuesday due to the death of a friend.
Nationwide, calls for police reform and accountability are multifaceted, with advocates calling for an end to practices like racial profiling and broken windows policing, and a fundamental shift away from criminal justice systems built on policing for profit. There are a number of ways that police departments can generate revenue. A system of fees and fines is one means. Asset forfeiture is another. FSRN's Lena Nosiswe reports from Los Angeles. California lawmakers on both sides of the aisle came together to support a bill to rein in the practice.
Close the roll. Tally of vote, ayes 66, noes 8. The measure passes.
After some 2 years of contentious wrangling, California legislators reached a consensus and overwhelmingly approved SB 443. The bill limits how much in assets law enforcement can seize from suspects without a conviction. It would also stop the practice of local or state law enforcement officials from transferring seized properties to federal agencies. Critics of civil asset forfeiture have called it policing for profit.
I think it's been running amok for a long time, and some of the legislation that just passed in California is meant to address that.
That's criminal defense attorney and law professor Steve Crone.
It's a system that maybe started with good intentions, but there have been so many abuses that it needs to be changed.
Across the country, law enforcement officials use civil asset forfeiture to seize more than an estimated $1 billion of cash and property each year, often without charges or convictions. Authorities can simply say they suspect someone acquired money or possessions as a result of criminal activity and then take it. The practice gained popularity in the 1980s as a legal tool in the so-called war on drugs. Proponents say it fights crime by cutting into illegal profits, especially from the drug trade, with seized assets going to law enforcement budgets. But critics say asset forfeiture is rife with abuse and based on the presumption that suspects are guilty. Past attempts at federal reform have led to minor changes, but now states are taking up the issue. The California bill would prohibit seizures without a conviction of $40,000 or less. As it stands now, the burden is on the individual to prove that assets were not acquired illegally. Supporters include the ACLU, United Farm Workers, and the California Association of Black Lawyers. Law enforcement groups who initially opposed the measure are now neutral. Democratic Assemblyman Jim Cooper cast one of only 8 no votes. Cooper, a former captain with the Sacramento Sheriff's Department, who also worked in asset forfeiture, says while restricting the seizures to $40,000 and less may not affect big-time drug dealers, he argues small-time dealers are an even bigger scourge to his constituents.
When we talk about small drug dealers, $3,000 or $5,000, whether you're hitting a small drug dealer or the big drug dealer, it's all the same in the neighborhoods. Think about the calls you get. That's the bottom line. No one's calling about the big guy, the small guy, because they're ruining the quality of life. And that's a big issue here. How do we deal with that?
While the most often stated targets of the forfeiture system are alleged drug dealers, they are not the only people who have had their cash and property caught up in the net of government seizures. Critics say that law-abiding citizens also carry around thousands of dollars in cash for legitimate business transactions like car purchases or payments of medical bills. Opponents of civil asset forfeiture say the battle for nationwide reform will be a long one. While a handful of states like Minnesota, Michigan, and Nebraska have also made changes in civil asset forfeiture, many more have yet to do so. On a federal level, the House and Senate have bipartisan support for reform, and the Due Process Act, the most significant update to national law on the issue, has already made its way through the House Judiciary Committee. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. For tomorrow's weather, expect a breezy day with periods of rain and scattered thunderstorms. Temperatures will reach the mid-60s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect a cloudy day with temperatures in the upper 60s. On this date in 1846, American dentist William T.G. Morton performed painless tooth extraction after giving a patient ether. This was the first demonstration of a surgical anesthetic. The quote of the day is from film director Paul Weitz, who has said, quote, "I think that comedy acts like an anesthetic, so you can talk about relatively painful things and have them be palatable," end quote.
Hillary Clinton's strategy to get under Donald Trump's skin during the debates may have succeeded beyond her wildest dreams, and she has a former Venezuelan beauty queen and recent U.S. citizen to thank. During the debate, Clinton referenced Trump's disparaging remarks toward the former Miss Universe, Alicia Machado. Soon after Machado won the title in 1996, Trump reportedly referred to her as Miss Piggy and Miss Housekeeping, and publicly disgraced her by putting her on an exercise regimen. After the debate, Machado appeared in a Clinton ad blaming Trump for years of eating disorders as a result of Trump's attacks. In the 4 days since the debate, Trump has increased the number and intensity of his attacks on the former Miss Universe. In a string of emails before 5:30 this morning, he referred to Machado's, quote, "disgusting past," alleged that she made a sex tape, and accused the Clinton campaign of assisting her path to citizenship so they could exploit her during the campaign. The campaign denied any involvement in Machado's citizenship and rebuked Trump for starting a smear campaign against Machado in revenge for her speaking out. Republican strategists are concerned at this point in the race that he should be focusing exclusively on Clinton. Also, his attacks on Ms. Machado further alienate women and Latinos, two groups that already hold Trump in low regard.
Donald Trump's increasingly confrontational comments since his debate performance don't seem to be hurting his bid for the presidency, despite allegations of illegal spending in Cuba, questionable practices by his Trump Foundation, and a relentless verbal assault against a former Miss Universe. A Reuters Ipsos opinion poll released today found Hillary Clinton has just a 5 percentage point lead over Trump. The pollsters say it is the same lead she has had since the start of September. Reuters reports that the poll taken September 23rd through the 29th found that voters supported Clinton over Trump by 43% to 38%. In the same poll, 19% said they would not pick either candidate. Two debates remain between Clinton and Trump before the November 8th election.
Bernie Sanders is hitting the road for Hillary. On Wednesday, Sanders and Clinton appeared together at a rally at the University of New Hampshire to endorse Clinton's candidacy and to connect with hardcore Sanders supporters. During the rally, Clinton repeated her campaign pledge to make public college tuition free for students of working-class families. The Vermont senator announced that next week he'll campaign for Hillary in the battleground states of Iowa and Minnesota. A Sanders spokesperson said that the senator will plan additional trips to support Clinton and other Democrats, as well as ballot initiatives that he cares about. Pollsters and strategists have noted that Clinton is still struggling to generate enthusiasm among millennials and diehard Sanders supporters, and that his backing is critical to getting these groups to vote. Sanders has vowed to campaign vigorously for Clinton and has publicly said, quote, Donald Trump must be defeated at all costs.
This weekend, water protectors will begin their seventh month of occupation near the North Dakota banks of the Missouri River, a watershed for almost 20 million people and thousands of miles of land that opponents say is threatened by the pipeline and its potential for leaks. Wednesday, police arrested 21 people, re-escalating their targeting of people organizing to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline, whose opponents have staged the largest multi-tribal mobilization of Native Americans in generations. Chris Genovanis reports.
He's got a gun drawn. He's pointing it at people.
We have no weapons!
We have no weapons!
That's Thomas Joseph narrating a cell phone live stream when police with armored vehicles and a helicopter disrupted a gathering of pipeline opponents Wednesday. The protesters were holding a Native American prayer ceremony at an active pipeline work site near the tiny hamlet of St. Anthony, North Dakota. 21 people were taken into custody on charges ranging from trespassing to resisting arrest. Thousands of Native Americans like Thomas Joseph and their allies have come from across the Americas to the windswept plains near the Standing Rock Reservation. And they vow to tough it out through the region's notorious winter months until the pipeline project is canceled.
If this pipeline goes through, it's going to damage our land and our water. And nothing can live in oil.
Winona Gasteau of the Cheyenne River Sioux oversees the kitchens for the largest encampment of pipeline opponents at Standing Rock. This day, she taught children how to butcher a buffalo.
We're only human, and we have to work together to save our future generations.
The response to the growing call for solidarity from people like Gasteau has exploded in the last 6 months, with multiple camps and literally thousands of people gathering near Standing Rock on any given day to oppose the pipeline construction route. The Standing Rock Sioux and their allies accuse Energy Transfer Partners, the company building the pipeline, of desecrating sacred cultural sites and running roughshod over their rights, charges the company adamantly denies. Opponents also argue that the pipeline, which the Brookings Institute says will create less than 50 permanent jobs, perpetuates fossil fuel exploitation and puts at risk a watershed that almost 20 million people rely on for clean water. The 1,100-mile pipeline would cross rivers, forests, and farmland in four states, carrying roughly 20 million gallons of fracked Bakken crude oil each day, much more safely than by road or rail, according to the company. But the disastrous Shelby County, Alabama spill earlier this month has sparked growing public alarm about the safety of pipelines. And Standing Rock water protectors note that a major Dakota Access partner, Enbridge, logged more than 800 spills between 1999 and 2010 alone, including the largest inland oil spill in U.S. history.
This is going to affect everyone down the Missouri River, not only natives, but I mean black, white, yellow, green, purple, whoever. You know, we all drink water, damn it.
Jasmine Harden, a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, came from Winnebago, Nebraska with her aunts and uncle, one of hundreds of family encampments making up the larger mobilization against the Dakota Access Pipeline.
This is going to be the ultimate change in America, and it's going to happen, whether they like it or not.
While lawyers for pipeline opponents continue to battle the company and the government in court, and the number of arrests near Standing Rock may soon top 100, on the ground, thousands of people like Joseph, Gastow, and Harden remain committed to waiting out and pushing out the pipeline despite the company's political clout and the coming winter cold. Chris Giovannis, FSRN, near the Cannonball River, North Dakota.
Canada's government has approved a massive multi-billion-dollar liquefied natural gas project. The same week scientists warn the Earth's climate has passed a grim milestone. Nell Abram has more.
The Earth hit a milestone this week, one which climate scientists say may be a point of no return. Data from the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii shows the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere stayed above 400 parts per million for the entire month of September, when it's usually at its lowest due to summer plant growth. As CO2 hit its highest levels in 400,000 years, the Canadian government gave the nod to the massive Pacific Northwest Liquid Natural Gas Project backed by Malaysian energy giant Petronas. Canadian Minister of Environment and Climate Change, Catherine McKenna.
I'm confident with the 190 legally binding and scientifically determined conditions that we will address the most important environmental impacts to ensure that this project proceeds in the most sustainable manner possible.
If built, the LNG processing and export terminal in British Columbia would be one of the most carbon-intensive projects in Canada's history. The Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives calls it a carbon bomb, out of step with the country's commitments to curb emissions. The $27 billion U.S. dollar project has met Indigenous resistance in British Columbia, where the Lac-Qui-Lam's First Nation is deeply split, with some members camping out to protect Leilu Island in the Skeena Estuary, one of the largest salmon watersheds in the world.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imc.org for Thursday, September 29th, 2016. Israel troops remove families from their homes in central West Bank. Meanwhile, in Gaza, soldiers attack farmers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded on Thursday the Hamsa al-Foka area near Tubas in central West Bank and removed 19 Bedouin families from their dwellings so the army can conduct a live fire training in their community. The planned military drills, which will use live fire and artillery shells, will be held on Thursday and again on Friday morning for 5 hours, starting at 6 in the morning. The army frequently conducts live drills after displacing many Palestinian communities in the Jordan Valley and Central West Bank. Many Palestinians, including children, have been injured, some killed, by unexploded objects dropped by the military during training. Moreover, the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, has reported that Israeli soldiers have kidnapped overnight and on Thursday morning 13 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers opened fire on Thursday morning on several Palestinian farmers working on their lands east of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. The farmers said that soldiers stationed across the border fence fired many live rounds, forcing them to leave the area, fearing of additional escalation and army fire. The soldiers attacked the farmers while stationed on their military towers across the border fence surrounding the Kisufim army base southwest of Deir al-Balah. The attack is part of a frequent violations targeting Gaza farmers, working and fishers in different parts of the besieged and impoverished coastal region. And that's all for today from the IMC News. This was the Thursday, September 29th, 2016, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imamc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For WIN, I'm Joanne Powers. Labor activists and their allies picketed the ultra-conservative Freedom Foundation's 25th annual fundraiser in Washington State last weekend to protest its anti-union actions. Having failed so far in their attempts to get the state to pass anti-union so-called right-to-work legislation, the foundation has stepped up its actions from harassing unions in the courts to a campaign of harassment and intimidation of individual union members. They have a very aggressive campaign of phone calls and door-to-door visits to union members' homes, trying to convince them to leave the union. Maxine Regal is a member of Teamsters Local 117 and a founding member of Organized Workers for Labor Solidarity.
Many members certainly feel that they are being harassed. And the Freedom Foundation is currently in court to try and get the full name and birth date of all Washington State public employees and expand this campaign.
Regal says that at its peak, there were 100 people on the picket line.
It was really quite inspiring because we were met with overwhelming support.
Owls notes that the Freedom Foundation has political and financial ties to major conservative pro-business foundations and individuals, including the Koch brothers, the Walton family, and the John Birch Society.
The Freedom Foundation does not directly list the John Birch Society or the Klan as funders or allies, but when you start digging into who funds who and where the money comes from and looking at